Diana Cooper, a painter who took up sculpture and who's now embraced the planographic in photographic form. Quite a departure in many ways, formally, to those of us who've been following her work. Whether you've followed her work or not in the past, Paddy, how do you respond to the integration of the flat and the three-dimensional in this show?
Well, I guess I should first begin by saying I have not been following her work, so that this is a departure for her.
An innocent eye.
It's not a, like I haven't seen the other stuff. I thought I really liked this show, and I liked it for sort of the elements of, I guess, the thematic elements of watching and surveillance that were part of the show. I know it took about 3 weeks to make, and a lot of the photographs that are in the show are, I guess I don't really see the work as being, in a lot of ways, that flat, because it's specifically responding to the space. So she might, like, she'll take a photograph of the skylight and then place it, like, right below the skylight. And there is, like, a beautiful kind of continuity between the shape and form, because that would happen, like, right at a corner space, and it happens in both the front room and in the back room. And I guess the elements of surveillance that were, I think, maybe a little bit less prevalent in certain spots. Like, one of the things you'll notice, I mean, I guess it's not specifically to do with surveillance in this instance, but if you look up on the, like, right over the corner of the doorway, there's several vents. And that gives you kind of a clue as to what she's doing, because you'll notice that some things, the vents, there's really only one original vent, but there's, like, about four or five on the wall. And then I think it's in the second room, you'll see on the floor, there's, I'm not sure what the word is for this, but basically they have this, like, little metal cover that goes over top of electrical outlets. So there's one there, but there's, like, a quadrant of four. So there's a lot of sort of constructed space. And my favorite part, though, is, like, on the way in, they have, like, one video camera, and it's, like, you can see the hole for it looks like this, but, like, she's taken a photograph of that and then duplicated it all around on the inside of the doorway, so you wouldn't even notice that this, like, surveillance system has been duplicated in any way, unless you were really looking. But it creates, like, it's just a beautiful pattern. And, like, throughout, there's a lot of pictures of, like, audience or, like, empty chairs in auditoriums and things like that. So the entire time you're reminded of, like, you know, looking and being watched.
Great. Well, I'm really glad the review panel has introduced an artist who you clearly are embracing it's a lovely evocation. I think that you were looking hard, creating patterns. That's to me, if I had to find four words for Diana Cooper, those may be the words. David, do you, it seemed to me also that Paddy was absolutely right on the money when in saying that the flat, the photographic, is actually very spatial, very dimensional. I mean, it seemed that, you know, those blue chairs really suck the eye right in. It seems that, to me, that the a very interesting kind of relationship between flat and deep.
I mean, this is a big departure from her work. So the kinds of plays with space she's doing in the show are quite different from what she's done before. I'm a big fan of the work that I started seeing in the 90s, mid-90s, she really found a way to draw in space. She made these constructions out of Sharpie filters, foam core, that just accumulated. There's kind of, it's kind of like accumulation clusterfuck coming off the wall, reaching into the space, growing, girders hanging off, tunnels going in. It was overwhelming. And she really, you know, her hand, when she brings her hand into play, is stunning. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. She's taken her hand out of this show for the most part. And so it's a really, you know, it's really different for me to get used to it. I can't say that I'm as in love with this work as I have been with her work in the past.
Just to interrupt a little, she was the one that did like the pipe cleaner type stuff in Postmaster, say, circa 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, I thought that work was a little fussy. Mm. Like, I actually enjoy this work a little bit more, especially because in my mind, she was like the pipe cleaner artist.
Okay. Well, that's one of many kinds of things that she used. And actually, the range of work is quite astonishing. And parenthetically, a number of these earlier works were destroyed in the hurricane in storage. So as ephemeral as they looked, it turned out to be quite, in fact, ephemeral. So the new... this show, you know, by introducing photography and particularly photography of the very architecture in which the piece is being, the pieces are being constructed, does take the work back to the sort of the site specificity of some of that earlier work, but in a very different way. I'm not sure I'm convinced by the sense, you know, by ideas of surveillance, ideas of sort of the tying the gallery into global commerce, which you get here. You have, besides, you know, pictures of the you know, cloning of the space of the gallery in various ways, and some of them really inventive and fantastic. You also have images of, global waste stream, bales of recycling, the kinds of nettings and webbings that you use for shipping things from country to country on shipping on large container ships. So it does seem like a very conscious tying in of how a gallery, you know, the gallery economy to the larger global economy, but I'm not so convinced by that. I think there's a very strong tradition that goes back to the mid-60s, people like Michael Asher doing, you know, taking gallery walls down that I don't think, you know, this show really works for me in that terms, but where it does work in terms of calling attention to the architecture of the gallery is to think about this particular space, this particular gallery, Postmasters, which moved to that space in 1998 and in the first wave of Chelsea and helped pioneer this kind of very different non-Soho look of clean architecture, aluminum and glass, concrete floors, and these, you know, projecting walls that Patty described as where Diana put these little camera clones on. No. And so, but in doing that, you start to actually pay attention to how the bloom is off the rose, because you see the cracks in the skylight, you see the bent blades on the vents, you see that the security monitor, which is reproduced all over the place, it's this, you know, 1975 Sylvania monitor. It's actually the monitor that they use for security in the gallery office, but it must have already been old in 1998. So. Okay. That makes it, just to finish, just to because I want to say that the thing that I like about it is that it shows how it distinguishes the Postmasters, which is not a sleek corporate gallery. It's a mom and pop shop. It's a very gallery loyal, artist loyal gallery that is interested in sort of the dystopian use of technology. So I like that aspect of the show very much.
Right. Okay. That gives a historic angle on it. Thank you, Peter.
Patty's sort of on the upside, and David seems, I wouldn't say in the middle, but you had a good and a bad part. I suppose, regrettably true to form, I'm a bit of a negativist on this show. All those things that were said were true, so I will just be general. One is that I'm quite suspicious of associations as credit to the artist. I mean, we make associations with everything that we see, and I sometimes get the idea that we in the audience are doing the heavy lifting. The second thing is that it's this kind of in-between work that I admit that I have difficulty with, which is that it's not encompassing installation, but it's more than individual works of art that are contained even implicitly with some kind within some kind of rectangle grid on the wall. And a couple of them, you know, there could have been more of them. There could have been less of it. I couldn't figure out where the necessary boundaries were and how much you put in and how much you don't. And there was one piece, the one with the swimming pool and the artificial grass and that sort of thing came in that was very rectilinear and contained. But that was, to me, one of the less successful pieces. It was sort of inert. I have a friend, an artist friend out in LA, another grump like me, who said about another artist out there who does similar work, meaning the work that's done on the wall and goes out and so forth. And he said the trouble with it for him was there are no conclusions to be drawn. And one of the things that got me about this was it left it at that kind of ambiguous point, you know, that neither fish nor fowl. For instance, the one part about the use of photography, I was very sucked in and taken in by the blue seating at Monticello Racetrack. Yeah. But I thought, you know, there's a perfectly good Andreas Gursky photograph, and it's got all these bells and whistles added to it, and it makes a configuration, you know, up there. But it didn't particularly, you know, add anything to it. The witty thing, which was the surveillance, you know, the photograph of the surveillance thing on the way out was... what I want to say, pleasingly clever. On the other hand, the last thing I say is that this artist suffered gravely in the aftermath of the hurricane. This show was I take it a kind of on-site, you know, made show, and so it had certain restrictions to it. And I you know, it's obviously terrible that Ms. Cooper's work was so devastated by the by the effects of the storm. So I don't want to get too about it. It just sort of sat there for all its busyness and cacophony and colorfulness and mix of transparencies and opacities and the real and the photograph. It surprisingly inert to me.
All right. Okay. Yeah, that's, I think, you know, it would be extra damage from the hurricane to be denied good, honest criticism of whatever you've done next. So I think, on her behalf, thank you very much for your candor. No, I think I shared the view, by the way, that, you know, at some points I felt this is an installation, and there are instances where it's definitely, there's that definite play with the space. And other times I thought, this is another piece. This is another piece, and this piece could be placed anywhere. It's not, it's just hanging in the gallery. But that didn't actually offend me. I mean, as soon as I adjusted to that, I realized, okay, yeah, some art is installation and some art is installed. And those are legitimate category distinctions. I don't think an exhibition needs to say this entire exhibition is going to be an installation, or this exhibition is of all detachable, non-site specific pieces. I think, you know, there's a healthy, happy swim from one to the next.
I think, you know, I think that her great strength as an artist is that she's a doodler. Yeah. She takes materials and she plays with them, and things happen. She thinks about them, but also she plays with them purely in visual terms. I thought, for example, the piece Turf, which is on the right, going down the right-hand wall as you're going, the second piece, was by far the most visually compelling, and partly because the photography in that piece works as pure texture. Mm-hmm. And then you can read it. There are images of grass and fake grass, and there's actual fake grass. So the photography works on several different levels. I didn't find the seating working for me that way in most of the pieces, for example. I found them as a reference to art as entertainment or something like that. And also, just to finish up with Turf, the other really smart thing that it does that I don't think any of the other pieces do is it uses the white of the wall, mm-hmm. integrates the white of the wall into the aesthetics of the piece, and it's very powerful. She also plays with this laminate, this very highly colored laminate, and cuts out, you know, confident, organic shapes out of it that really arrest the eye. A lot of the other pieces just felt like, you know, she hadn't come to terms with the use of her new materials yet. She yeah. hadn't taken ownership of them. But that piece, you know, shows that she's certainly capable of doing it, and, you know.
It felt transitional to me. What I've really liked about her work in the past was the obsessive, compulsive color categorization, that she'd almost be like going out to find anything that could be the right vermilion to put into this piece, and some of it would have baggage from its prior life, and some of it would simply be raw material, and then it would give you this strange sensation of having to work out for yourself, really, whether the components have the residual element or whether they're raw, which is, you know, one of the, you know, I think to my mind, one of the crucial ongoing problems of any artist working in any form of collage. Here, yeah, it seemed pretty a very noisy show, and one which is sort of at the one hand getting bigger and on the other hand getting flatter by going out into the world and finding or making photographic images to then be brought back and to work in a kind of sculptural way. So I do feel, to my mind, it's a transitional show, but it seems to have a very big energy and kind of encouraging. I find myself asking myself a question. I say, okay, some of these seem to have an aesthetic that's kind of just on the same page as Jessica Stockholder. Some of them have an aesthetic that's on the same page of Sarah Z. Which artist is she really closer to? I didn't answer the question for myself yet.
Can I jump in for a second?
You can.
I think she, you know, her work from the 90s and, you know, helped pave the way for artists like Sarah Z or Phoebe Washburn, who has a piece out in the hallway. I think there are a number of artists who were pioneering that sense of accumulation and using stock materials in interesting ways. But she's probably... you know, I think that is an issue. Like, it's not, you know, Sarah Z, Jessica Stockholder, Sarah Oppenheimer, who's done these very clean architectural installations, have really cornered the market in a certain sort of the cleanliness, the clean use of these vividly colored Home Depot materials, and you know, so this show kind of has to, you know, it doesn't, like, if you looked up at the security monitors in that quadrant. Where there's a kind of a crossing, and these monitors are at an angle. They're kind of warping, and the paper's delaminating, and it doesn't quite work as sculpture. It's not clean enough to bring off that, you know, security monitor vibe. But it's not the hand isn't in it enough to take it to someplace else yet. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it is a little bit in between.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see that. I think I came out pretty much in favor of this show, for which a position I think I pretty much maintain. Although I do think, like, for example, the auditorium pieces, like, that were pointed out, like the seating pieces, I think those are amongst the weaker work. They sort of, to me, they work as a whole within the exhibition to move forward a theme, but individually are, you know, less compelling. I do think that this particular installation benefits from multiple viewings. And I say that because when I went at different times of day to Postmasters, and there's one moment, if the light is the right kind of light, then that's shining through the skylight, then it looks exactly the same as a photograph. And that's kind of a beautiful moment. And then to go back and see that it's like not at all the same color, there's a certain kind of uncanniness there that happens that from a repeated viewing that I think benefits the show. And I guess I would say that I would agree with you that the monitor as it was constructed wasn't perfect, in that I like the history that you brought out and the from Postmasters, and that maybe recalls that, and then that's a layer that you know, can be added to the show that you know, that I think you know, brings a community element into it that's, I think, really nice.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, we will have till February the 9th to go and see Diana Cooper at Postmasters Gallery. So our final show, David Shrigley, seemed very true to form of the Anton Kern Gallery with its kind of Sloppy Joe semiotics. But I really could
not... make that up now.
I did make that up now. I know you think I've been rehearsing that all week. But,
no, I want to use it.
I was actually... What I was trying to do was remember the exact words to an Ezra Pound quote about signs and symbols, which would be much more erudite and impressive. And now I can't remember it, but it's something about, you know, symbols. And signs are better than symbols because... symbols are, you know, once the symbol has changed, you're in trouble, but the sign can reinvent itself. I don't know that Ezra Pound would have liked this show any more than I do. But I want a champion of David Shrigley to lead this discussion. Who loves this show?
Not me.
Somebody recommended it. But anyway, Peter, where did it leave you?
The thing that hit me when I left the show was I was reminded of an old Fawlty Towers episode called The Germans.
Oh, yes. Don't mention the war.
Don't mention the war.
Right.
Okay? And he goes up, you know, where he's been hit on the head and he's a little... So he makes these tasteless jokes to the group of German tourists who are at the table, and he has these awful puns like... Tonight, one of our specials is Eva Prawns.
Right.
You know, and he goes on like this, and finally the woman at the table breaks down and cries. And Fawlty, you know, says in his officious way, why is she crying? And he says, can't you see? It's not funny. And the part that reminded me of the show is Fawlty stands back and he says, not funny? Not funny? Meaning, I've given you my A material and you don't think it's funny. Completely oblivious, you know, to the... And I went out of there thinking, it's not funny, and I'm convinced that I'm missing something. You know, there are layers of, this is so obvious because it's supposed to think it's obvious, and then, you know, certain other little layers peel back and reveal itself. The two things that I thought I genuinely got a chuckle out of, and I don't know whether that's the point of the show, was the traffic light over the little kind of pet doorway be through the thing. I thought that was funny. And the other one, having worked in journalism, was one of the word pieces that said news, colon, something new found yesterday.
Right.
Which I thought, those two things, fine. But a lot of the rest of it, and I'm part of the reason I'm thinking about this, I'm easily influenced, is that I noticed that the New Yorker Talk of the Town did a little interview with him.
Right.
As if he were, you know...
Well, it turns out he is something of a celebrity. When I expressed my bemusement at this show to a young friend, she said, oh, yes, the show sucks, but he does great pop videos. He's done great MTV things. That's where his genius lies. So I actually went onto YouTube and didn't find the great one. Something that did strike me as kind of interesting is that there's a big book about him at the sign-in desk. And I opened the first page, and the Independent said, you know, witty, outrageous, da 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 da. And this is a newspaper I like and respect, and lots of different people saying, you know, great humor. And I thought, oh, well, okay. And I flipped through, and actually came across one that was pretty funny, actually. It was a man reading a sort of newspaper, and on the back it said sport, and on the front it said misery. And I thought, yeah, that is a newspaper. It's got, you've got misery at the front and sport at the back. And but I thought, maybe he does cartoons for the general public and pop videos, which have a kind of iconoclastic humor that sometimes works. And then he does this in an art gallery, and he takes some of the humor out because he thinks it has to be art. Paddy, did you laugh?
Not yet, but I mean, we did an interview with him a while back that we ran on the site, and he had said that he throws out about 70% of his work. And I guess my sense with this show was that a lot of this could have fallen in the 70% that he just edits out.
Was he talking about his cartooning or about his gallery work?
A lot of his cartoons and quicker things, but I like the pet door with the stop sign. I like the blue cat that had the words "kill your pets" on the front of it. I thought that was kind of funny, I like the two cats that said. There were two black cats that said,
yes.
It's okay, it's not okay.
Right.
And I kind of like that these two identical cats would say the exact same, or the exact opposite thing. Although I don't really have a great explanation for that. There's a lot of stuff that just was kind of boring.
Yes, but art only has to be interesting. So is this art, David?
No, it's. I'm really surprised by the show, because Anton Kern is a good gallery and they show good artists and they usually put on good shows, and this was pathetically.
And he's had good shows there.
And I'm sorry because I've missed those, and I did look. Was unfamiliar with his work. I did look through books of cartoons and online, and one in 10 was reasonably okay, and the rest were pretty average for sort of alternative newspaper stoner cartoon type art. So there's nothing special, the cartoons, but whatever life was in the cartoons does not make it into bronzed words, bronze letters saying words, or even worse than bronze, neon, saying backwards burger. There's so many artists who have done interesting things with words, including cartoonists like Saul Steinberg with, charging yeses coming down a hill, going into obstinate noes and that sort of thing, there's the bar is very high. Ed Ruscha had a brilliant show at Gagosian, very, stunningly austere, ideas about sloppy Joe semiotics, if you like. It's a great phrase. But the artist that comes to mind who I want to compare him to is Bob and Roberta Smith, who's a British artist who has, strong class consciousness. All of his work is funny, all of it's bright and beautiful to look at. There's just sign painting, enamel colors. There's a kind of utopian idealist naivety to them, but also self-deprecating humor everywhere. And for all of their particular, what I'm assuming is a kind of particularity of their place in British society, and coming from a provincial, I think he comes from someplace like Hull.
Macclesfield.
Thank you. For all of the class consciousness of their work, it travels. When I did a terrific show at Pierogi Boiler last year, or a couple years ago. And so the humor travels, the ideals...
Oh, sorry, Bob and Roberta Smith are from Hull, yes. I think it's Strigley that's from Macclesfield.
Okay.
Carry on. Yes.
Yeah, so anyway, it is possible that, I'm missing some of the regional humor in Strigley's work in this show, but it doesn't seem like it. Whatever was there, it's not traveling to Chelsea. Even the backroom stuff, which particularly references Christopher Wool's work, and Wool's, like him or hate him, he has a kind of austere hermeticism that's powerful. So that would be funny if he did a kind of takedown of Christopher Wool in that work. But none of those phrases are I guess the one that Peter pointed out, I missed that, and I kind of like that. There's something about handwriting, which was kind of
funny. That's my favorite one, yes. But they like my handwriting, but I don't. And it's very hard to read. You have to read it carefully.
Yeah, so, you know, but none of them are funny enough, you know, to make much of an impression. So I'll just leave it at that.
We might.
I mean, I just don't think that, like, I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, but my impression of Schrigley is that he kind of, like, he is also, like, very involved in the music scene, and that's, like, maybe his strength is not, you know, making art, like, historical references just because it's not where his main interest lies to begin with.
Right. I think my friend was right. The music videos is where his heart is at, so to speak. I'm from the same little island, and I find, you know, I'm from the same, not the same region of the same little island, but there's a sort of English eccentric mixed with angry proletarian sort of feeling, but it's sort of, it's Tracy Emin without any libido. So I sort of kind of inclined to give him the advice that he actually puts in one of his text pieces, fuck off back to the library. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. See you next time.